Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
It's the Drink Talking with the Thinking Drinkers, Ben McFarland and Tom Sandon, and Mistress of Wine, Sam Capon. All the booze news and views from Absinthe to Zinfandel. Gin, gin, what?
Hello, everybody, and welcome once again to It's the Drink Talking. Stop what you're doing. Listen to this because it's important. I am joined, as ever, by our lovely, lovely hosts, Sam Capon. How are you doing, Sam?
I'm great.
Good.
All the better.
That's enough. And Tom, how are you doing?
I've been better, Ben.
Really good. Okay, well, things are about to get better because I'm hosting this stuff this
Yay.
Week.
Yeah.
So, Sam, you're going to be banging on about wine.
Yeah.
Tom, you're going to be desperately trying to codge together some notes and talk about spirits.
I'm talking about vodka. So
yeah,
that's all right.
It's just, it's just vodka, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just vodka.
So,
no technical side to it.
So I'm hosting and I'll be talking about beer in the Spit or Swallow section, which is coming now. So, first of all, right, okay, my spit is the price of beer. It's too cheap.
Right? What the?
Yes.
No, it's not.
It is. It's too cheap. Listen to this, right?
I told you about my £9 pint
the
other week.
That doesn't matter. Well, okay, I'll tell you why that's fine. Because we had a little discussion about this last time you mentioned your expensive pint. Okay, because recently there was a brouhaha. See what I've done
I
there?
I love it.
See? Nice. Relating to the price of a pint, there's a pub or a bar, a sort of craft beer speciality bar in Borough Market called The Rake. It's been around for years, run by two guys called Mike and Richard. Really know their stuff. Really, if you know your beer, go there, then you'll be very impressed. Now, they have recently made it into the national press because they were selling a beer called Cloudwater Double IPA. I think it was called North Coast IPA.
What's a double IPA?
It's just an IPA, but goes up to 11, pretty much.
Ooh, it's so strong.
Strong beer. More hops. But they were selling it for £13.40 a pint.
Punchy.
Yeah, okay.
They made it into a bottle of wine for that.
Well, okay, well, exactly. The Mirror ran it. It was this outrage, this idea that how can you have a pint of beer costing £13.40? Firstly, why not? Why is beer priced so cheaply? Why, if you're making a beer with the right ingredients, the right amount of time, passion...
So why is it so expensive to produce, I wonder?
Well, it's in small batches, there's a scarcity value to it as well. Mm-hmm. They're not a massive brewery, and they make consistently good beer. They do different beers all the time, and they're constantly evolving what they do. So they've developed a massive following, and so they do sell their beer a bit more expensive. At The Rake, £13.40. It's 9%. So they're not selling it in pints. They're selling it in half pints, but it is then priced up to the pint.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you actually look at it from a wine point of view, you're looking at, it's around £4 for 175 milliliter.
Actually, not dissimilar from what you'd get for a glass of wine on the on-trade.
Mm. Would it be a good glass of wine? Probably not.
I mean, the last time I bought a pint of wine, I had to spend near what you're talking about.
Exactly.
I wouldn't even put it in a pint glass.
No, but this is the it's equivalent of a £17.70 bottle of wine. Now, in London, in Borough Market, if you went to any of the restaurants around the Rake and said, "Can I have a bottle of wine, please? But I'm not willing to pay more than £17.70, you would not get a bottle of wine.
Unlikely.
Very unlikely. And if you did, I imagine the quality of it would not be very good. The problem is, as a nation, we always value beer in pints. Mm. And it's an age-old issue because pints historically have been how we drink beer back when we had the mass industry and we built things and had people actually doing proper jobs for a living. Pints were what people drank because it was 3-4%. They drank pints to refresh themselves.
Like water.
Mm-hmm. As things have changed and beer has become stronger and more flavoursome, the pint isn't all of a sudden looking like a little bit out of date. And you're seeing this in some of the speciality beer bars as well. They're selling beers in a third and a two-thirds and a full pint. And that's only been allowed recently in the last few years. They've been able to bring
this... special names?
Two-thirds of a pint. Yeah, not, I think someone tried a schooner because that's in Australia. I've never been to Australia. But listen up, guys. If you want to take us to Australia. So this idea that beer should be drunk in a pint. If you bought a glass of nice wine... and went, oh, that's nice, but if I bought a pint of this, it would be £18. Mm. No one talks about it, man. It's ridiculous. Yeah. And also, some beers are going to be £13.40 a pint because...
They're better. Yeah, I mean, basically, it's consumer choice. There's nothing wrong with having that choice. If you don't like it, don't drink it. If you want to try something boutique, exceptional, expensive, then lucky us for having that choice.
The problem beer has is it's been seen as a commodity for too long. And you can't, as we have discovered in business, Ben, if you price yourself down, and Gin's found this as well, if you price yourself down for too long, it's very difficult to change people's perception of what it should cost. And Gin, two of the greatest gins in the world, Beefeater and Tanqueray London Dry, you can pick up a bottle of them for 15 quid in the supermarket. They can't get that price back up because people are used to paying it. And that's why there's hysteria, because the people who are upset aren't people who understand.
Is gin is quite a cheap process, though? I always think, and maybe you can touch on this in the vodka section, but I always think of producing a spirit being pretty simple. Kind of get a tank, whack everything in, take it out again.
I would suggest that actually of all the processes we talk about here, it's the most complicated and none of us can do it, whereas we could all have a go at making wine and beer, but you have to be very well trained and indeed get a licence, which you have to qualify for.
And also it does take, if you're doing whiskey, a long time.
And then you have to spend 3 years putting it in a barrel and wait for it to be ready, and then it still tastes bad, but so you have to wait another 10 years before it's even any good.
Okay, so the barrel ones aside, like the cognacs and the whiskies and the bourbons and all those, but with something like a gin, I'm just questioning the fact that it's cheap and what you're saying. I perceive it as being quite a straightforward process, in that is you have sort of tank of botanicals, you ferment it, you move it on.
Right.
You don't have to hold on for it for long. There's not the cash flow issue. There's not the aging it in oak. It's more like a white wine. An unoaked white wine that's made in a stainless steel tank, much more of a cheaper proposition than anything that's gone in oak, that's been aged. Or
we can to and fro on the production values that go into making Beefeater are extraordinary. And in terms of sourcing those botanicals and getting them at the right time of year, you have to be very careful with those botanicals. You have to look after them. It is definitely worth more than they're charging for it. But the point is, to take back to what Ben was talking about, is the gin went through a phase of 20 or 30 years where it just wasn't popular and people weren't buying it. So they had to bring lower the price. Mm. Now, gin is incredibly popular and people will not think twice about spending 30 quid on a bottle of gin now. Mm. What I'm saying is Beefeater is as good as the gins they're spending 30 quid on, but they perceive that as a cheaper gin, so they won't. And that's what's happened to beer. Unfortunately, it's not going to change a certain demographic, is it?
To take the spirit analogy, is that like the other last podcast two podcasts ago, we tasted that £2,000 bottle of Hennessy. Mm,
that was amazing.
I went to Hennessy.
You did
on
mention
a plane,
it.
Private jet. That trip.
But you wouldn't say, you know, God, I can get a bottle of Napoleon brandy for £12.
I wouldn't, but there are people out there who would say, you spent how much on a brandy? I can get Napoleon down the supermarket.
Yes, so it's the same with any luxury product.
Problem,
you know,
what
a £5,000 watch,
timepiece,
does the same job as you know a Casio number. But that's not the point, is it?
No.
And also, if you want to buy a Casio, do it. But don't complain about people who pay more. And the same goes with beer. But Cask Ale is the big problem with the price of beers, because historically, Camra, who've done some amazing stuff in reviving Cask Ale, the campaign for Real Ale, as they are a consumer group, they have consistently campaigned for being at a lower price, which is crazy because it's harder to make, it's harder to look after in the pub than lager. But it's consistently priced considerably lower than lager, which means
demand.
Well, it's not only that, but they have to, publicans have to get rid of the beer. They have to sell the beer over a 3-4 day period, otherwise it's done. Mm. So if they price it too high, they think people are not going to buy it. So they price it lower to get the throughput, which means that any brewer brewing cask ale is not going to get as much money for cask ale as it would for keg beer. So now loads of people like Cloudwater, they've just said, we're not doing cask because we can't.
That's a real shame, isn't
and,
it?
And if you think about the ingredients and the love and the care and attention that goes into brewing cask ale, and people are saying, I'm not going to pay more than £3.10 a pint. I mean, if people put 30p on a pint, then that does certainly raise it. I mean, over 10 pints, that's another £3. Mm. It's an amazing bargain. And I think the real scandal with beer is that you can pay about £5-6 for a shit pint of lager. You're paying for the marketing, you're paying for the badge, you're not paying for any of the quality there. But people will not blink at a kind of snazzy European lager because it comes in a nice glass.
But that's the thing, it's like everything. There's a market for different people. So, for example, you know, there'll be people who want to drink a big branded beer or wine or whatever, and they're very specific about how much they spend. Mm. And, you know, basically a large volume product is generally cheaper. Whereas if you get something that's more boutique and that's made in smaller quantities, I think generally people understand that you then need to pay more for that.
But just to finally bring this to a close, you never hear in the newspapers about a bottle of wine costing £60 in a restaurant. There's never this outrage. Yeah. But with beer, because we're obsessed with the price of a pint, it just seems to be something that, you know, oh my God, I spent more than a £5 a pint. It seems to be this thing that is locked into the British consciousness, and it needs to change, because if none of these breweries can make any money off it, and if pubs can't make any money off it, they're going to continue to push wines and spirits at the expense of beer because they need to make money. And so next time you buy a beer, don't moan about how much it costs because you're getting a fucking bargain, all right? So there we go. That's that one.
Ooh. Passionate about that, Ben.
Swallow. A lot of beer marketed at women. Terrible. There's lots of breweries throughout the ages have tried to design a beer marketed at the ladies, and there's been things called like female, if you saw what I mean, with ALE.
Never seen it.
No, there's a reason, because it's shit.
Right.
condescending, patronising, packaging, awful stuff.
There's, with kittens on the front.
With kittens on the front. So there's been all that. So it was quite refreshing to read that there's a Portsmouth brewery who've designed a beer called Liberation for ladies going through the menopause.
How does that work? Talk me through that.
There's a woman down there who's Joanne Francis, the co-owner, who spent 6 years researching and designing a beer that will help with the change.
So it's got full of HRT in it?
What's HRT?
Hormone replacement therapy.
No, I don't think it's got therapy in it. but it does have.
This is going to be an interesting one, Ben. I'm not sure. Can I just say, are qualified to go into this?
Can I just
subject?
Say, before we go into this, that I'm going to be trying very, very hard. I'm treading carefully here.
Yeah, I would.
I'm not.
Why do they think it helps menopause?
Well, I'll tell you why, but that's a very good leading question. Well done, Sam.
Because the best way to get through it is just to drink.
Okay, because she's consulted a psychologist, Sylvia Pollock, and she's a kinesiologist, which I think is a whole load of different therapies, like physiotherapy, things like that, and a herbalist and a wellness practitioner. And they've designed a gruit-style ale, which is gruit is basically a beer brewed with herbs rather than hops. Quite fruity, quite spicy, apparently. But the beer contains ingredients that herbalists believe can help to alleviate some of the symptoms caused by hormonal changes experienced during a menopause. And these include motherwort, lemon balm, chamomile, stinging nettle, mugwort, rose, chickweed and damiana. And they add a little bit of hops towards the end during secondary fermentation, which obviously hopefully makes it taste decent. And apparently it does work.
Okay.
Intriguing. One can't help but think that the quantities of the herbs in the beer are going to be so minuscule that they'd be hard pushed to make a morale.
But also going through the process of fermentation and quite rigorous heating. I mean, I suppose you could put them in a tea, so that would make them work, but going through fermentation sounds like some of the medicinal value might have been.
Well, whatever you think about it, it's better than what they used to do in the Victorian times.
Well, this is
what was that?
I wondered where we were going. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, did you know that the word hysterical comes from the Greek word hysteron, which means uterus? And any I didn't know that hysterical was related to the uterus. So there we are.
It's all anything like that is always related back to women in negative ways.
Because men were the only ones that could read until about 10 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we made up all the words. In 1890s, menopausal women had their ovaries removed to prevent idiocy, mania, or death. So at least they don't do that anymore. And this is bad. Mm. This is bad. How much do you think they have to spend on their periods in a lifetime? And this includes sanitary products, pain relief, new underwear, toiletries.
A lot. Go on, tell us.
Apparently, this includes also. I'll give you the context because they've included magazine and comforting chockies. Apparently, this is the actual.
Let's go for $5,000.
No, it's
going to be more than that, isn't it?
It works out about £40 a month.
No, that's rubbish. £40 a month on a packet of Tampax?
No, but then they've got... You've not
and
factored in new underwear here.
The flowers. Yeah,
you can take the expensive kit off.
£18,450, apparently. That's a survey conducted amongst 2,134 women.
Bizarre. I'm going to say bizarre. I'd say liberation... Schmiberation. Yeah, I'm a bit cynical about that, I've got to say.
Nice.
But maybe I'll come back in 10 years' time and tell you it's amazing.
Yeah.
I think it's a good little story. I've done a research.
Good stories are our bread and butter.
Well done, those guys. I think you've made a good decision there. So, do you know one last thing? What's the only other animal that gets menopause?
Penguins?
No.
Do you know penguins suffer from depression?
They do.
They walk off into the middle of nowhere on their own.
The thing is, they look so happy. That's what's so wrong.
It's difficult to know. When they're walking, it's such a comedy walk. You think, oh, he's
he can't be depressed.
He's walking into the abyss.
Yeah.
Yeah, really sad, isn't it?
Poor penguin.
The thing is, they are just sort of, what have they got to do with it?
I mean, you've got to say to them, nothing's black and white.
going back to which animal also has a menopause, I'm going to go for elephant.
Whale.
I was going to say
they're quite bright, aren't they? Dolphins, I'm surprised.
Can you imagine
not in
a moody whale?
Elephants, right. Dolphins and whales, I would have said that, yeah. Any of those are in the mix. Or penguins, which is what I went for.
And apparently a whale's willy weighs a ton.
Does it really?
Yep.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact? You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time.
For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
You're listening to It's the Drink Talking.
So let's go on to the next thing we're doing, which is a tasting. Tom, you seem to have some colourless liquid in front of you.
I do. We're going to taste vodka. And what I'm hoping to do for you guys, and hopefully encourage for the listeners, is the notion that some people think all vodka tastes the same. And there's
doesn't it? Come on.
There's a really big movement in the industry at the moment to try and change that perception about it.
Are they trying to ginify vodka?
No, they're talking about terroir, though, which will interest you as a grape enthusiast. And Ben, you've got grapes as well, so you might be interested.
I like it.
They want to get back to what the real roots of vodka, where it all comes from. Now, the big push for vodka over the last 100 years has all been about purity. So it stands to reason that most people who approach vodka in the present day tend to think of it as a neutral spirit. In the 1800s, they started to distill more than once. They started to filter their vodka. And this quest for purity was what drove everyone forward in the industry. And then in the 20th century, we really jumped on the vodka bandwagon, particularly in America, after they'd gone through Prohibition. Now, Prohibition was a ridiculous idea. It completely backfired on the Americans. But one of the side effects was the fact that there was no booze. When it came to being legalised again, no one would age their spirits because they wanted to make money quickly. And no one wanted intense flavours because they hadn't been drinking any alcohol for 10 years. So everyone started to go for very neutral palate products. So fizzy yellow beer that didn't taste of much, and vodka. And vodka stepped into this gaping hole in the spirits industry and took it by storm. And today it remains the number one spirit in the world. It's still the biggest selling spirit. And people
I don't drink a lot of vodka unless it's in a Cosmo.
Well, there you go. But a lot of people add it to mixed drinks because it doesn't taste
of
much.
Yeah.
They like that about it. It gives them their intense buzz without being too challenging on the palate. What's happening to our palates at the moment, people? Why are we doing this podcast?
We're all developing.
Because we want to taste things again, don't we? Our food has become more important to us and our drink is becoming more important to us.
Umami's in town. It wasn't in.
Well, exactly.
No,
right.
It's umami
tastes
really
when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which I think means delicious, doesn't it?
Don't know what it means. Actually, that's a bit
right
of
in, folks.
Ball-dropping moment. Just to give you an indication of how flavourless vodka might be, in America, the criteria for what it must be still stands as distilled to at least 95% ABV, so has to be without distinctive character, aroma, taste or colour.
Now, sign me up for a litre.
Yum, yum.
Now, if you're making something...
From potatoes?
Right, so vodka can be made from anything. That's a good question. Vodka can be made from anything. Anything that can provide a starchy sugar substance that can be fermented can go into a vodka.
So it's not made from potatoes?
Predominantly, it is made from grains, but also potatoes.
Particularly in Russia? Or have I made that up?
No, the Polish like it. And here, Chase Vodka is made up in Herefordshire, and they use their own potatoes, which they grow in the farm, and then they make their vodka. Great vodka. Potato gives your vodka a slightly oily, richer mouthfeel. The grains vary in terms of what they can give it.
Barley, wheat, rye.
Barley would give a sort of crisp. Rye would give perhaps a more peppery, earthy flavour. So already we're talking about different ingredients.
Can you have a corn vodka?
Yes, you can, yeah. It's slightly sweeter.
I'm trying to think of more grains.
Buckwheat. Yeah, I mean, they all...
Quinoa?
They should.
Quinoa, can you make a quinoa?
They should have an effect. I haven't tried quinoa or couscous, but
We're having that.
Okay. Well, already you're talking about these things as though, well, they should have an effect. And they do.
Wow.
The reason that we don't really associate vodkas with these flavour differentiators is because they filter them. So they distill take all the stuff out. Not anymore, people, because vodka is enjoying a resurgence. And last week I went to a tasting with Belvedere. Now, Belvedere are one of the bigger vodka companies, and they are by no means first to the party when it comes to adding flavour to their vodka. But they've just launched two vodkas at the same time, one called Smigory Forest. Now, Belvedere is Polish, so please appreciate my Polish there. One called Smigory Forest and one called Lake Bartoszek.
Bartoszek.
They use rye at the base of their vodka, and they've got six different regions where they, or even eight different regions where they take their rye from. But what they started to do is look at each of those different blends and say, well, actually, you know what, guys? This will taste a bit different. So let's see if we can just distill with one region. So they took some from a forest and some from by a lake, and they made different distillates.
Right.
So let's taste them. See if they
taste it. And I've got a question.
You've got a question.
So, like, with some big companies like Absolut that make flavoured vodka.
Okay.
How's that made? Just well, chuck flavouring in.
Yeah, that's a very different conversation. And we can do flavoured vodkas on another occasion. But yes, depending on the process, some of them will use aroma chemicals effectively.
Thanks.
And as a result, it can taste synthetic. So if you get a strawberry vodka and it tastes of
tastes of the things
yeah. you think should taste like strawberries.
Yogurt.
Exactly. Opal fruits, which we've talked about before.
Do you know, if you had two yogurts side by side and one was pinker than the other, you'd taste them and you'd find the pinker one to have a stronger strawberry taste, even if they tasted exactly the same.
Why? Okay. Because you're...
Just, I just think, because you know what we're talking before on the other podcast about senses of taste, and it's just so linked with sound, sight, all your other... jobbies, that basically if people wanted to think of a way to make consumers think the flavour was more strawberry, just make it look pinker.
Okay, so this is the Smigori. That one is the Bartoszek.
This is the river. Is this the river one?
Bartoszek,
the lake one.
Is the lake one.
And I'm putting the Smigori. B one before the S one, like the alphabet, so I don't get confused.
And this is your Smigori Forest, okay?
Smigori Forest.
Give them a smell and give them a taste. Now, bearing in mind you are super tasters.
Which one was what?
So
B was river.
Yeah.
B is for by the river.
Yeah.
S is for forest.
Right. Now, as you're doing it, I will tell you a little bit about what they've achieved here. Because they've come from different regions, and you'll know this because of terroir, but the forest, the rye grain that's grown in the forest has taken on a lot more of the characteristics that you associate with things that are growing near woodland. So it's a bit more earthy and a bit more mushroomy.
They are different.
They are different. Yes. Boom.
I definitely prefer the cleaner, crisper, watery one.
Oh, my goodness, she is a super taster.
I find the second one more mossy.
Unbelievable.
I'm getting...
More earthy.
Ben, you're a peasant, so we don't really care.
I can taste little birdies in the wood one and fish in the river one.
Ben can taste his sugar puffs from this morning.
Cocoa Pops.
Ooh, they are different.
They are different, aren't they?
Point proven.
They are. Well, it should be proven because they've done a hell of a lot of organoleptic chemical research on it, and it actually is true. So it's just as well you can taste the difference, folks, because I wanted to prove the point even further by going to Vestal Vodka. And this is actually made by an English company, and this is a potato vodka. So that's two rye grains you've tasted there, and now this is a potato vodka.
Without wanting to... throw a question that you
as more like tequila
that you might not know the answer to. What kind of taters do they use? Are they
well, Ben? They've kindly sent us three samples. We really can't get through them all. We'll be absolutely battered. but we've got the Vested Pomors or Pomorge.
Pomorge.
P-O-M-O-R-Z-E.
That's jolly distinctive.
And they take the potatoes from Poland, Ben. Sorry, just to finish on that. Redskin Asterix. Potatoes.
Oh,
so that's quite cool,
that's
isn't it?
That well-known
cool.
That's potato. Cool.
And they come from the Baltic coast, and they only have a single distillation at Vestal.
That is
so
punchy.
Vestal are kind of more pioneering in this. Although Belvedere have made a big splash about it recently, Vestal were kind of a bit ahead of the curve in this, just doing single distillations, not filtering. They, the people who make it, grown up around Poland, and they were very passionate about going back to this original idea of how vodka is made and how crucial that base ingredients is to your experience of it and how terroir in vodka.
And it does have the oily, they've got that one, the Vestal, whatever you call it. It does definitely have that more...
Yeah, it's not as crisp
it's
and
just
clean.
More, yeah.
I don't know if you're getting any of the other things they say off it, but I do get a bit of licorice off it.
They're very different, even though they are... Even.
I find that extremely pungent. To me, that's almost heading towards tequila.
There
even though they are both made in Poland, they are... Poles apart.
Oh,
Love it.
They are very different, aren't they? Mainly because one's made from potato, I imagine. The other one's made
from
grain.
But that's the point, isn't it?
I mean, that
on
is
the back
massive.
Bar, there are about 20 different vodkas of choice, and they're all going to be made with, well, different. Not all, but they're going to be a lot of them made with different things.
And Tom, that's fascinating. I really enjoyed that. They really are different.
Which
they
was
are
your
massively
favourite?
Different.
Without a shadow of a doubt, the one by the river.
the Belvedere Lake Bartaget. Okay, yeah. Ben, what did
Probably because I quite like my vodkas more neutral.
Clean and crisp,
and I like that freshness.
Yeah, the Vestal I really, really liked, but it is very characterful.
Yeah. Mm.
And it has that kind of creaminess to it.
Well, there you go. There's three different vodkas we've just tasted here. Mm. If you bought them all and sat down, you could actually take your flavour progressions through all the different areas you can go with vodka and have a nice evening also, drinking too much vodka.
But I'm also very suspicious of those vodkas that their sort of marketing line is that they've distilled it like eight times.
Yeah.
You're like, well, that just sounds like you've just killed everything.
I've got a question. Yes. Hopefully not as irritating as I suspect it could be.
Well, we'll find out.
So part of me wonders, with a lot of these vodkas, are they all just going to have a mixer chucked in anyway? Ergo, what's the point? Or are these more expensive ones? Do you drink vodka on its own, or is it for vodka martinis?
Well, OK, so this will probably set you back somewhere in the region of £40 to £50 a Belvedere. Mm. The ambition of the company and the world of vodka is probably that people at least approach these and drink them neat. Drink them like they would a whiskey. And when it comes to rye, like a rye whiskey is a big, powerful flavour that you would drink independently. You wouldn't. Mm. You can have it in great cocktails. But I think it's unrealistic to expect everyone to go out and buy this and drink it neat. Having said that, it is brilliant neat, and it goes really well with food, particularly seafood. Mm. And I think that if you can find a way to integrate something like this into a dinner party with your mates, it's a real point of difference.
My wife is half Polish, and so we have a Polish Christmas. Mm. They celebrate on Christmas Eve, and vodka is massive. We have about five or six toasts during the meal, and you just have to stand up and tell everyone how much you love them and all that kind of nonsense. But you have a vodka with each time, and then you have sledge, which is basically herring and onion on bread. Sounds horrible. It's absolutely lovely.
Delicious, yeah.
And then the vodka really cuts through. Mm. It's amazing. And they
Aren't you just shit-faced in it?
Vodka is something that historically I've always had issues with. Yeah. It just swept my legs away. And I like it, but I'm very wary of it from a just, I don't know why, it just goes right to my head. Mm. But I'm getting better.
Yeah.
They talk about it, like my mother-in-law and her sister, and they will talk about the different vodkas and which ones they like. And it's certainly not, in a vodka-drinking culture like Poland and I imagine Russia, they talk about it in the same way you would with whiskey in terms of different types and variants, and you know, have the bison Zubrovka, bison grass
that's
vodka.
That's one to try as well. When you talk about flavoured vodkas, that's,
yeah,
that's
at home, actually.
A slightly different flavouring process in that they rush it through grass and put it in with a piece of grass in the bottle.
And now you whack it in the freezer. And it really is.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Vodka's been kicked in the balls by the 20th century massively.
But also, I think it's been kicked in the balls by our drinking culture.
You can chicken and egg again, but I think the mass production of it and the neutral flavours of it go back to what you're saying about beer. Hmm. And it's just a big process of trying to get like a Chardonnay grape, you know, just trying to get those products that have lost their way a bit
back on the forefront of the mind.
There was a reason people liked them in the first place.
Well, so
done, Tom. That was fascinating. I like the one from the wood.
Good.
Did you?
I like them all. All the vodka makes an effort.
I could imagine like a moose. Yeah. Like walking through it, stopping.
Probably more like
looking
a bison
up at the sky. Mm. Yeah, do they have moose in there?
I don't know. They have lots of wildlife in the area, which they claim affects terroir, Ben. So it's nice to
and
talk about badgers and things.
Here's a question for you. Why is the plural of goose geese, but moose isn't meese?
That's a good question. Listeners,
write in.
Right, yeah.
I'm presenting this bit. Yeah. Yeah, sorry, I just sat back rather smugly thinking, I'll leave that one there.
Move on.
Now, Sam, you want to tell us about some kind of legend. This better be good because the rest of this podcast has been amazing. Don't let us down.
Okay, I'll try not to. My legend of liquor is quite an interesting one in that I recently feel I sometimes come up against a bit of wine snobbery. And I don't know if you guys get this in your industry, but...
Not really.
But I just don't talk to anyone.
I don't know. There's various places I've worked in and da-da-da-da, and you get exposed to maybe finer wines. And then lastly in my career, I've been very commercial and I've bought for sort of big companies and wines that aren't as sort of expensive, but are more kind of widely available.
Yep. And accessible.
Accessible. And to my mind, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. You want to introduce people into the category. You want to get people off sort of RTDs, introduce them to wine. And going with what we were saying before about like sweetness, You know, you want wines that are approachable, easy to drink. Certainly from the New World, you don't have all the complication of, you know, it's from Sancerre, therefore you have to learn it's a Sauvignon and da-da-da-da. And I went for a tasting recently with a bunch of people. And
was that about the people or the tasting? Okay.
People.
Okay, wait a minute.
Sam, you do realise this is going out on air, okay?
I do realise I do quite a lot of tastings.
Yeah, so I've done one tasting.
Come on, tell us more.
Who are these people?
I'm not telling you. But someone made a comment about the whole of New Zealand wines. You know, oh, this New Zealand wine's nice. Not like the rest of them. And you think, bloody hell, you know... And
was that Oz Clark?
No. No, Oz would never do that. But, you know, some people just need to get a grip on the fact that their little demographic of fine wine is not the market and it might be nice, a bit more inclusive. So, to that end, having got my bloody back up that bloke did with that New Zealand comment...
Oh, it's narrowed it down.
who could it be?
My legend of liquor is a guy called John Casella, also a living gentleman... And he is the brains behind the enormous brand that is known as Yellowtail. Now, I'm assuming you guys have heard of Yellowtail.
Yeah, for sure. But it's discounted in Co-op. I buy it all the time.
Is that a bird? Is it a bird?
No, it's a kind of a wallaby or something like that, I think. It's some sort of Australian marsupial.
Is it?
Yeah. Really? Okay.
Yeah. It sounds like it should
be a bird.
It's
got a tail, though.
Correct. No, I've got a picture of the label here. I can show it to you later. It's called Yellowtail. It is like a kind of a wallaby. It's very Australian. But you know what? This guy, I just think this story is absolutely fascinating. So his parents were Italian immigrants. They came over to Australia in the 60s and they started growing grapes and they set the winery up in something like 1969 or something like that. And they just... they supplied basically the grapes to other people making wine. Then they made their own wine. And I used to go and buy wines from them when I was an Australian wine buyer. And you'd fly to Sydney and then you'd get on a little plane, almost worse than those people. you know, these little kind of 20-seater planes.
Paddle jumpers.
I call them a private jet.
And you basically fly for another hour to this hilarious place called Griffith, which is in New South Wales, and it's been this kind of Italian settlement, and it's got a bit of a mob reputation.
Oh, right.
And you'd hear people tell you all these stories, and it's this amazing kind of wine community, but basically people who are making quite large volumes of wine. So you get quite a lot of big wineries based there. All their register plates will be like one giraffe. Giraffe is an Australian grape, and it's just...
it's not an Australian giraffe, then.
No. And it's just this really kind of extraordinary, unique place in Australia. You know, it's not massively sophisticated. It's not like Sydney, but an hour from Sydney and you'd go to this really amazing, unique place. Anyway, the Casellas, who set up the winery, there's the lady who's called Maria and her husband's called Filippo.
Big Phil.
Filippo.
And they basically established the winery. And then it was their son, John Casella, who is my legend, who then decided that he wanted to create like a big brand that kind of went away from the snobbery of wine and people could just enjoy it. They didn't have to worry about region, vintage, varietal, just a really nice, easy to drink. So he basically came up with that in 1994.
Right.
Okay. The business is now valued at 1.5 billion Aussie dollars.
Crikey. I don't know what the exchange rate is.
I don't know, but it's still quite a lot
of cash. It's going to be all right.
G'day, mate.
But the two things I really like is that, he became managing director in 1994, and in 2001, he created the Yellowtail, which was the Wallaby label. It's enjoyed in 50 countries around the world, and more than 2.5 million glasses of Yellowtail are drunk every day. But what I liked is when I went to go and see them, we did an own label made by Casella for the company to work for. And Maria, the mum, who sadly died in 2014, she still lived by the winery. Like, they had their little house that they had, I guess, built themselves. And this extraordinary winery, I mean, I remember going to see it and it's like bigger than a couple of football fields. Mm. I actually got mildly agoraphobic. It was so massive. Mm. This all just grew up around her and she stayed there. And John always comes out and sort of welcomes you and says hi. And just the fact that they've just created this extraordinary brand from scratch. And she could have gone and lived in a multi-million pound house.
Sold out, moved on.
And it's all about family. And I think that, you know, the guys would go to hers for dinner dinner every night, and it's very family, very Italian, and just all about enjoying wine, sort of enjoying life, enjoying family. And I just think they've really got their head screwed on. Yeah, and
nice.
I think
I'd like to hear that. They were
good. And are they still independent?
Yes, and that's a really interesting. So John,
surely
owns,
someone's been kicking their tyres and trying to buy them.
Yeah, so they've just, I think, had a share buyback agreement because they didn't want it to become not family owned. So my understanding is that John owns 50%, and his two other brothers, Joe and Marco, share the other 30%.
Yeah, you've
and
got
20%.
To do that if you really want to retain that.
But I just think it's amazing. And I remember going to a tasting when I was at a magazine, and we went to a tasting, and the guys I was with were a bit like so sneery about Yellowtail. And it's just easy to drink. You can drink it on its own in front of Strictly. You can have it with food. It's kind of, you know.
Okay, can I drink it in front of Strictly? Thanks.
I don't know. That's, do you watch Strictly?
That sounds like a punishment.
But I just think. I just think.
Just bottle yourself.
What an amazing success story. You know, you don't have to be Hennessy to be a massive success story.
But it helps.
You know, you can have your private jets and your big companies, and actually you can have a little Italian family
that
emigrated to Australia
in
the 50s.
But do they, as well as doing these kind of entry level, very accessible wines, do they then showboat with some wines that are kind of like, okay, if we really wanted to, this is the kind of cool stuff we can do.
That's not their market. They do have some more premium wines in their portfolio, and interestingly, that recently they've been buying some other wineries as well. So they're expanding.
Sam has just shown me a small picture of a big field, and a winery. That does look big.
That's all the vineyards, but can you see that's the winery?
That is very, very big. It doesn't work brilliantly on podcasts.
It's not great for radio. Google it. Casella Winery.
I mean, I suppose there's always going to be, in everything we talk about, there's going to be more noise at the top end because people have got more to say about the kind of elite examples of each beer, wine and spirit. But actually, the vast majority of wine is drunk. It's below a certain price point, isn't it?
And so would you say, if
you're looking at brands, there's a sort of handful of well-known brands like Jacob's Creek and Wolf Blass and people like that. Would you say Yellowtail is consistently reliable?
I think they all are. That's the whole point. Yeah. You have a whole handful, particularly of, you know, Australian brands, and they're really popular. They're kind of good value. Now, it's difficult because you don't need to talk about terroir. You don't have to talk about vintage. The whole idea is that they're reliable. You know, they taste the same year in, year out, and consumers know what they're getting. There's no surprises. As obviously a wine expert, you know, there's not loads to talk about with how the wine's made. You know, there is an element of an FMCG behind it. You know, it's when you've got a brand this big, it arguably becomes a bit more of a commodity than if you've got a tiny boutique winery and they're, you know, they're spending tons of time and money and effort, but equally the skills of these winemakers and being able to get out wine that's consistently good and reliable.
Yeah, and you need that in wine, don't you? You need to take away that mystique because not everyone's
different.
Going in at the top level. And if you want to get people drinking wine and interested in wine, you have to make it accessible so that people step
and
up.
I just think, you know, certainly with what I do, I think there's just so many people who just concentrate on the top end. And I'm always far more interested in more in the commercial end, and the majority of people are actually drinking and what represents good value, what are nice wines. You know, you don't need to be spending £30. I mean, obviously they're delicious.
No, I spent £4.99. I think that's
I think the fact that it's family owned is a real plus point. I mean, if you look at that other Australian institution, Pippa's Caravan Park, I mean, they were
flaming glass.
They were family owned and remained true to their roots. Yeah. I mean, she remains steadfastly independent. No
is this
one,
Home and Away?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I've just got to pull you back on the Hennessy thing, private jets and Hennessy and all that. Seventh generation master blenders there.
Yeah.
Although I think there's a way. The problem is, if you sell, you don't have that guarantee in 200 years that they'll be owned.
And they're making one just like a mama used to make.
Yes, that's my legend. I just think, wow, entrepreneurial, successful, but humble and still with priorities and, you know, producing a very reliable wine that a lot of people love.
Legends.
They get our legends. New South Wales. Well done.
Legend.
There we go, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for listening once again. Next week, we will be back with more chat about booze. So look forward to that. And all that remains for us to do is to say cheerio.
Cheerio bye.
Cheers.
This was a Grand Cru podcast.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From 7 Digital.